Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 254. A Psychiatrist's Most Bizarre Cases with Gary Small, MD. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The only time psychoanalysis is required is when you become a psychoanalyst yourself. But a lot of psychiatrists do go through their own therapy, and it can be tremendously helpful. And I've found over the years some of the best therapists are those who have had their own therapy. So they've confronted their own emotional issues, and they've learned from it. And it really gives them a capacity for empathy for what patients are going through.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Gary Small, discussing the importance of personal psychotherapy as part of psychiatric training. Gary Small, MD, is co-author, along with his wife, Gigi Vorgan, of the 2010 book, The Naked Lady Who Stood on Her Head, A Psychiatrist's Stories of His Most Bizarre Cases. I interviewed Dr. Small 2 years ago on episode number 188, about their earlier book, iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Dr. Small is a professor of psychiatry at the UCLA Simmel Institute and directs the Memory and Aging Research Center and the UCLA Center on Aging. He's one of the world's leading experts on brain science and has published numerous books and articles. Scientific American magazine named him one of the world's top innovators in science and technology, and he frequently appears on The Today Show, Good Morning America 2020, and CNN. Dr. Small has invented the first brain scan that allows doctors to see the physical evidence of brain aging and Alzheimer's disease in living people. Among his numerous breakthrough research studies, he now leads a team of neuroscientists who are demonstrating that exposure to computer technology causes rapid and profound changes in brain circuitry. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Gary Small, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
Well, it's been 2 years since I interviewed you about your book, iBrain, and now you and your wife have come out with another one already. And this one is about some of the most bizarre cases you've treated.
That's right. It takes you through my 30-year career from being an insecure first-year psychiatry resident at Harvard's Mass General Hospital over the years, gaining more experience and insight as I moved to UCLA, and describe some of the most unusual situations and cases I've seen. And they're all a medical mystery, each one describes a different kind of mental condition, and it aims to destigmatize psychiatry, try to get people to understand the human side of it and how a psychiatrist thinks, feels, and reacts to not only these unusual situations, but more usual ones as well.
Well, I think it really succeeds in those goals. I have to say that.
I have to say
the title, The Naked Lady Who Stood on Her Head, sounds like an homage to Oliver Sacks. Was that your title, or did the publisher come up with it?
Well, you know, we came up with it. We debated about it, and we went back and forth, and we just thought it really gave you a sense of what some of these situations are like, that they really are startling. And I think that's what happens when you see a lot of cases over the years. There are some that really stand out and are striking. And the question is, what can we learn from them? I mean, they're interesting stories because they tell you about the extreme of what our minds will do, which is in part what drew me to psychiatry, how behavior and mental gymnastics are really quite fascinating.
Well, you must have a better memory than I do, and I know memory is one of your special areas.
But, that's right.
But I would not be able to recall the cases from over the course of my life. So to me, that's remarkable. Maybe you took good notes.
Well, I think it's because it stands out that you recall those cases, and probably as we start talking about it, when I talk to other doctors about these cases, they will start thinking, well, I had this case and I had that case, and once I start thinking about one and then the other, then another one comes to mind. And it's a bit like memory in general. Situations and experiences that have an emotional impact often stick with us the most. So,
yes.
You know, we remember that the first kiss, or even tragic situations when President Kennedy was shot, or what we were doing when we found out about the 9/11 disaster. I mean, those are moments in our minds. They're seared into our brains. We don't forget them.
Yeah. Well, I love the format of this book. Each chapter is like a little short story complete with dialogue, and yet the stories are also chronological, so that we get to watch you progress and mature through the course of your career from, as you say, a psychiatric resident to the present day.
So I think that was our intent, to not only help readers get inside my head, but also understand more about the making of a psychiatrist and how there are struggles that we go through in our profession that are not unlike what anyone goes through. I mean, the first time you're a teacher and you have to stand up in front of a class, it feels awkward. You're kind of playing the role. And how do we go from role-playing to really becoming that professional that we want to become?
Right. That, in fact, was a theme that kind of ran through several of the early stories. As a clinical psychologist, I have to say that these case histories helped me to appreciate the added value of medical training. Most, if not all, of the cases in the book start out with symptoms that look like they could be completely psychological, but end up having a key medical component that I, as a psychologist, would have completely missed.
Well, that's something that I've always been fascinated about in psychiatry. In fact, I was thinking of becoming an internist originally, and did an internal medicine residency. But I found when I was doing the internal medicine that it was the psychological side that was so fascinating to me, and it just was remarkable to me that the interaction of the mind and body is so intricate and so mysterious, yet sometimes we can unravel those mysteries, understand them, and help people.
Well, a good example of one of the stories that had that sort of unexpected, at least for me, unexpected physical component that I would have missed is the chapter that you titled Brain Fog. I'm hoping you're not suffering from brain fog and that you'll be able to recall it. I don't want to give away the diagnostic punchline before you have a chance to tell the story. Can you take us through that one?
Well, this was a man who came to me who was a VIP at a major studio. I don't mention, we changed the characters around and the names to respect confidentiality,
sure.
But the essence of each of the stories are very real. In each of these situations, I bring up some of the reactions. For example, how do you deal with a VIP patient, and how do you deal with your own reactions to that? And some of that comes up.
Right. You were a little starstruck there.
I think a little, there was some of that there, and I admitted to it. I think it's important to recognize that's a human response, and accept it and not let it interfere with your purpose of trying to help the patient.
Definitely.
But he was complaining about what he described as brain fog. You get sort of fuzzy and in the afternoons, and you go through the medical detective work trying to figure out what's going on. I kept thinking it was some kind of psychological stress at the studio. And he was always working out and drinking water, and the clue came to me when I was actually visiting him in his office, and he was drinking all this water, and he was having one of the episodes, and it occurred to me that maybe he had a drinking problem, and it wasn't scotch or bourbon. It was too much water. And when it occurred to me, I accidentally knocked his water out of his hand, and we got some chips and crackers and Gatorade, and he came to. And of course, before we did that, we checked his blood sodium level. So this is a condition that's often called polydipsia, and I recall seeing it when I was a first-year resident. Some of the chronic schizophrenic patients, we had to restrict their water use, and it can really change your brain focus to the degree, and it can be very confusing, and it can be life-threatening at times if it's very severe.
Yeah, that's fascinating. See, water intoxication is something that never would have occurred to me as a psychologist. And your medical background was an essential component, as in many of the cases that you relate. And even so, it took you a while to tumble to it, as it did in several of the cases. It makes me think of Dr. House, who always has to go through 5 diagnoses before he gets it right.
Well, that's, you know, it has, each of the stories has an element of a House episode. And if people like that TV show and they're interested in psychology or psychiatry, they'd probably like this book.
Yeah. That's one that has been a favorite in our household. My wife is particularly into that show. I had heard of water, you know, we were going through a time, it seems to me, of water mania in a way. I retired not long ago from teaching at Sonoma State University, and just about every student is hauling around a big liter bottle of water and taking slugs from water all the time.
Well, water is good for us, and it's much better to be drinking water than sugared sodas, but too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. That's probably true of anything in life. And it's almost a theme of the book, is to try to find that balance in our lives. You know, I'm thinking now another case of the woman who had sort of serial addictions, and we see this often. I mean, when I first saw her, she had a food addiction, and then when she came back in, she had a shopping addiction, and then the unusual aspect of her situation, it turns out she was developing kind of a therapy addiction. She was sort of hooked on the euphoria she experienced from the insights in therapy, and was sort of cheating on me during therapy, seeing a colleague, and I wouldn't realize it. So it brings up a lot of issues about how can therapy be helpful when you're having too much therapy. It may be not serving you to the best interest.
Well, speaking of therapy, I was interested to read that you went through a psychoanalysis as part of your training. Was that a requirement of your program?
The only time psychoanalysis is required is when you become a psychoanalyst yourself. But a lot of psychiatrists do go through their own therapy, and it can be tremendously helpful. And I've found over the years some of the best therapists are those who have had their own therapy. So they've confronted their own emotional issues, and they've learned from it. And it really gives them capacity for empathy for what patients are going through. And that's another thing that Gigi and I really tried to convey in each of these stories is there is a lot of humor, a lot of it's self-effacing. We try to be respectful of the patients and try to show their side of their struggle.
Yes. And one of the things that impressed me is that you value both talk therapy and pharmaceutical interventions. And I think many of us think of psychiatry as really pushing medication these days and devaluing talk therapy.
I think that's a stereotype. And, you know, sure, there's a reality to every stereotype, but there are so many very effective and helpful practitioners who use this kind of balanced or eclectic approach and help so many people. And there are just a variety of different conditions people suffer from, and they are suffering. Maybe 1 out of 4 people at some point in their lives has some kind of psychiatric condition that would improve with treatment. And antidepressants, antipsychotics, other agents really do have a tremendous impact and help people. But the medicines are not the only approach. If you just throw pushing pills, you're not really going to get to the root of a lot of these problems.
Well, I totally agree. You seem to me, though, to take a very balanced approach to the use of talk therapy and medication. I'm sure that you're aware that traditionally there's been some rivalry between the professions of psychiatry and clinical psychology. I don't want to put you too much on the spot here, but I know that was the case in the past. And I'm not sure what the current status of that is. I know there's a contingent within psychology that's been pushing for prescription privileges along with the training that would make that possible, of course. And I've heard people speak to both sides of that debate. Do you have a point of view on that?
You know, I think, I've seen less of that controversy over the years. I know when I was in training, there was concern about it. I think that the physicians, felt that, well, goodness, I went to medical school all these years to handle medication. Mm-hmm. You know, why do I want to give this privilege to a non-medical person? But, you know, what I found over the years, it's really the individual who can be helpful or not helpful.
Yes.
And, I don't think my own opinion is there's not a magic that happens to a person if they get an MD, and there could be some kind of training where, non-MDs can prescribe medication. We have nurse practitioners who do a lot of work that's very similar to what an MD does. So I think I'm feeling less territorial about these kinds of jobs. And what I've seen is, when I refer a patient to another practitioner, I'm not thinking so much about whether they're a psychiatrist or psychologist, but who is that person and what are they effective? What kind of treatment modality are they effective in?
Right. Well, while we're still on this topic, I guess you've probably worked in settings where there was an interdisciplinary team that included a clinical psychologist. Is that the case?
Sure. Yeah, well, and also we have a lot of, in our research team, we have a lot of, in clinical teams here at UCLA, we involve a lot of psychologists, particularly neuropsychologists in the assessments, and they're terrific collaborators.
Yeah. What do you see as the value of an interdisciplinary approach to treatment?
Well, I think that people bring different backgrounds to the table, and that can be tremendously helpful. We can't do everything ourselves. And I think that patients do get better treatment very often when they have an interdisciplinary team. Now, there is a limitation to that. It gets to be expensive. When you have a lot of bodies around taking care of a few patients, we just can't afford it in this health system. So if we have interdisciplinary teams, we've got to be very effective in how we use their time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess my experience in that context goes way back to when I was in training, and I did internships at the VA. And so the VA often had interdisciplinary teams like that. But that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but we still do that. Particularly on our inpatient unit, we have lots of meetings where the whole team gets together, and it's very effective.
Yeah. One of the cases in the book led to your developing some expertise on mass hysteria fairly early in your career, and that's an interesting phenomenon. There's some famous cases of mass hysteria in the past, kind of historically, but I guess it still happens. What can you share with us about this fascinating phenomenon?
Well, it's really, when I was in my residency in the first year, I was watching the 11 o'clock news, and there was a story about a bunch of school kids fainting and being rushed to the hospital in a Boston suburb. So I drove out there in my 1974 Toyota Corolla the next day, talked to people, and the next thing I knew, I was doing a study on it and learning about it and finding out some very interesting and fascinating aspects of the condition that, in fact, as you say, they are very common. And whenever people get together in groups under stress, it's remarkable to me that it doesn't happen more often. And they can create real problems if you don't diagnose a psychological cause. Of course, it's important to look for physical causes because today we have so many environmental toxins and sick buildings and real things going on in the environment that can affect people's health, but there can also be a psychological component to it. And so in this particular story, you find out about the first experience I had with it and some of the individuals involved, a lot of the defensiveness that the families feel when if you say to them, this is psychological and not physical, and how we dealt with that.
Yeah, that was a fascinating story. The subtitle of the book refers to your most bizarre cases, and one that I think might get the prize for the most bizarre phenomenon.
I know the one you're going to say.
I wonder. It's the one titled, Take My Hand, Please. Is that the one you were thinking of?
No, I was thinking of another one, but that was a pretty bizarre one, too.
Okay, well, let's start with Take My Hand, and then you can tell us the other one.
Yeah, Take My Hand, Please was a 28-year-old carpenter who felt that he just didn't seem to be himself unless he could amputate his left hand. And I found out about this in couples therapy. He was hiding this urge from his wife, and she mentioned that at Halloween, he dressed as the one-armed man. from The Fugitive.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was kind of funny, but then she said he kept wearing the costume after Halloween, and eventually he confessed to his desire, and I actually had to hospitalize him against his will because he had a buzzsaw at home, and I was concerned he was going to harm himself. This is a very rare form of body dysmorphic disorder, and it's very hard to treat. A lot of these people continue to have this urge. In the short run, he did better when his wife found out about the urge. She felt less excluded from his inner life. But I didn't get follow-up to them in the long run, so I'm not quite sure what happened with him.
Well, I had heard of this phenomenon. I remember seeing a TV program. It might have been 60 Minutes or 2020.
Yeah.
But it showed a number of people who insisted that they needed amputations of arms or legs in order to feel whole.
Yeah.
And some of them had actually, you know, gotten one way or another, gotten those amputations. And it does seem very bizarre.
There was actually a case of a guy who just thought this through so methodically. He put his feet into, he wanted his feet amputated. He put them into ice so that they caused gangrene, and actually jimmied up his car so he could drive it without his feet and get himself to the ER for the required amputation. So these people actually often think it through and complete their desire, and it's just a tragic outcome, and it's something we don't completely understand how to treat. Fortunately, it's very rare. But it also brings up, you know, each of these stories that are unusual, they bring up the usual and raises questions about how we all tend to spend a lot of time thinking about how we look and you know, who hasn't had a bad hair day, or people who feel they have too many wrinkles on their forehead. When is it normal behavior to want to change our appearance, and when does it become extreme and abnormal?
Yes, there's always that continuum. Do we know anything about what's going on neurologically with these people? I guess it's so rare that it might make it hard to study.
Yeah, there are hypotheses. I couldn't find anything that was that satisfying in terms of really understanding the physiology of what's causing this problem. It's almost a very severe form of obsessive compulsive disorder, or you could say it's another presentation of something like anorexia. Instead of wanting to be thin, you just want an extremity removed. So it's kind of a strange phenomenon. You know, you can think about anorexia, how many women who have this condition, one can look at magazines today and the popular culture, how it's important to be thin, and that perhaps there's a psychological element to this, an element of wanting to be in control. But here with the body dysmorphic problem, it's another step beyond that.
Yes. You know, this a somewhat distant association, but I just saw this movie called 127 Hours.
Yeah, that's been a lot of press. How did you like that?
Well, you know, ambivalently, just so the audience knows, this is a movie about the fellow who got trapped. He was hiking, it looked like, maybe in the Moab area of Utah or maybe in Arizona, but he got trapped by a boulder. His arm was pinned, and he ended up sawing his arm off with a little Leatherman tool, a knockoff of a Leatherman tool. The movie is very well done. It was done by Danny Boyle of, Slumdog Millionaire. And, you know, difficult to sit through in some ways.
Yes.
I was hoping that we weren't really going to have to experience that.
Yeah. And you know what's going to happen because we all know that story.
Yeah. At the same time, you end up feeling like, God, what a triumph of the human will to live, though.
Yes, you know, I think that, and we see that in so many situations. And here's a situation that's it's very unusual. But in this case, in order to survive, he has to cut off his arm, and you have to hand it to the guy. No pun intended for doing what he did. It took a lot of bravery and really thinking it through.
Yeah. One of the things that comes through was that even though he ended up in this situation, in many ways he was really well prepared. I mean, he seemed to know a lot about survival and improvising in the wilderness kind of thing, and just seemed to be an exceptional guy. It makes me curious to read the book. I don't know if I will or not. He'd be a good guest. I should try to. I should see if I can get hold of him.
Well, I think where that story differs from the stories of the naked lady who sit on her head is that people generally don't know the outcome. I mean, it kind of hopefully gets them curious as to what's going to happen with each of these stories as the plot unveils itself.
Yes. Now, when I talked about the most bizarre one, you thought I had chosen a different one. Which one were you thinking of?
Well, I was thinking of the shrinking penis, and that was quite unusual.
Oh, yes. Tell us that story.
Well,
you can't leave us there. You can't leave us just...
Yeah, that's right. This was a couple that was referred to me. I was already at UCLA and had more experience, and he was an attorney who was trying to make partner at a big firm downtown, had a lot of stress, 3 kids, a lot of tension at home. And during the first couple's visit, I asked him about their sex life, and he really seemed not to want to talk about it and said he had to leave early and get back to the office. And his wife told me pretty much nothing was going on in the bedroom, and she talked about how there was an incident where he had a towel around him and seemed to be hiding what was going on. And it made me curious. And the next session, she didn't show up. And he started seeming a little bit bizarre. And I was concerned that he was psychotic. And it reminded me of very brilliant people who are psychotic and seem to make it in life. They're able to compensate for the chronic loss of reality, the delusions or hallucinations that they're experiencing. And another famous case was depicted in A Beautiful Mind about the mathematician had psychotic episodes, yet he accomplished just remarkable things in his work. So this fellow, I started him on a low dose of an antipsychotic. He seemed to be a little less agitated. But I was late to meet him for a session, and when I walked in, his pants were down, and he was applying some kind of ointment to his penis and putting a prophylactic on it, and I was pretty shocked. And it turned out that he revealed to me that he believed that his penis was shrinking, that was a somatic delusion that he had that improved with antipsychotic medicine and some psychotherapy. So there's really, checking with his internist, there really was no physiological explanation for a truly shrinking penis, and so it was really coming from his mind.
Well, I'm trying to remember. I'm a little hazy. The cream that he was putting on his penis, was that in fact causing some shrinkage? What was he putting on there and why?
Well, he had a corticosteroid that had been prescribed for a rash, a pubic rash.
Oh, okay.
And so he felt that was, in his delusional belief, he felt that was somehow stopping the shrinkage. but it wasn't. And in fact, it was probably making things worse.
And so an antipsychotic sort of helped him to come out of that?
It helped him get some distance on the delusion. And of course, you know, you can have a Freudian heyday in terms of interpreting what that delusion meant. I mean, here was someone trying to make it his partner, which is a sign of virility and strength. And of course, you know, a lot of men focus their virility and strength on the size of their penis.
Yeah. I hate to have you give away too many of the fascinating case examples in your book. I'm wondering if there are some good ones that come to mind that didn't make it into the book.
Well, you know, there were. And in fact, what started happening as we were in the process of writing the book and developing the proposal, there was a long list of cases, and a lot of them didn't make it. So, for example, there was an interesting case. I thought this was an interesting case when I was at Mass General in the acute psychiatric service. A woman who came in, a young woman who was home from college, and her parents brought her in to the ER because they said she just, you know, there's something with her. She's not the same. And, you know, I talked to her, and she talked about having, you know, she had a crush on one of the college professors, and I couldn't see anything abnormal about her. A couple days later, they brought her in, and she told me that she was actually going to marry her professor, and that seemed a little bit off. And then she told me that the Pope was going to do the marriage, and that they were flying Bob Dylan in to play at the ceremony.
Uh-oh.
And so what was interesting to me about this was that I couldn't notice any difference, but the family did. They couldn't pinpoint what it was. And it just tells you about how there are subtle aspects of behavior that sometimes we just can't pinpoint, and we know someone is not quite right. So now, you know, I'm very, very much take it to heart when families tell me something isn't quite going right. So that case didn't quite make it. Turned out she had manic depressive illness, where she, you know, that was sort of a manic delusion that she was experiencing, and she was not sleeping, and so she had these ups and downs in terms of her mood. So that was one that didn't quite make it. There's another one I thought was kind of interesting that didn't make it, where it was a couple that had been in psychotherapy, but not with me, but with somebody else, and he was an older gentleman, and a friend of his, actually, the wife was concerned because he didn't remember the lessons from the previous week in couples therapy. And so, you know, she took that to mean that he didn't care. Finally, he was referred to a neurologist who diagnosed Alzheimer's disease. This is many years ago. And the neurologist, there were no medicines for it, just gave him a pamphlet to read. He was devastated from that. He knew a friend who had Alzheimer's disease and went downhill very quickly. And at the same time, he needed some dental work. And he just decided to have all his teeth removed because he figured he'd be in a nursing home in 6 months. When they finally got to me, it turned out he didn't have Alzheimer's. He had what we call depressive pseudo-dementia, meaning that he was forgetful, not so much from Alzheimer's, but from a depression.
Hmm.
And in fact, he improved with an antidepressant medication, but he still had dentures and he had lost his teeth.
Wow.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting how people will take to heart these diagnoses. And I'm very careful when I talk with people about a diagnosis, particularly Alzheimer's disease, to try to understand what it means to them. What's important to me is not so much the diagnosis, but that they're getting the right kind of treatment and right kind of help.
Yes, well, Alzheimer's is, in fact, one of your specialties. And one of the most poignant stories you relate in the book concerns an older colleague and mentor who consulted you and was showing signs of incipient dementia. And I think I recall you mentioning something about dietary and lifestyle changes that can help to either prevent or delay Alzheimer's. Am I remembering that correctly? And if I am, what sorts of preventive things were you talking about?
Well, that is true. In fact, we have a big research program on that at UCLA, and there's been a lot of studies showing that physical aerobic conditioning, healthy diet, the heart healthy diet, Mediterranean diet is not only good for your heart, but it's also good for your brain and probably delays the onset of Alzheimer's and is something very important for all of us to think about. In fact, the book that Gigi and I are working on right now is all about this kind of approach to Alzheimer's prevention.
Oh, well, good. I guess there'll be another interview.
Hopefully I'll be back in another year.
I'm hoping you will be, too. This reminds me of another interview I did with a Harvard psychiatrist. You probably know his name. I'm blocking on it. But he wrote a book called Spark.
Yeah,
it was very much about the benefits of aerobic exercise on all sorts of conditions. I'll look forward to your book. Recently, good. PBS has been running a promotion on brain training software designed by a company called, I think it's called Posit Science Corporation. And they claim that there's considerable research supporting the efficacy of their software. What are your impressions of this type of software for staving off mental decline?
Well, you know, let me disclose that I've worked with companies on this approach, not Posit Science, but another company, Dacom, and develops handheld games for Mattel Toys and Radica Games. And I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that's out there is fun, and it does exercise your brain, and our studies have found that it does change neural circuitry. The question is whether it really makes, does it really stave off Alzheimer's disease? That we don't know. And does it really have an impact in everyday life? For example, you may get really good at the game, but you still may forget people's names. And what we've actually done at UCLA is develop memory classes that are available across the country that helps people with these more practical memory techniques. And those, in fact, have been shown to improve memory, improve everyday memory skills, and the improvement can be observed for many years.
Are these online classes or?
Well, those, we're actually working to get them online right now. We're working with the computer science department at UCLA to create more engaging games that people can use and get help with their everyday memory problems like names and faces, forgetting where you put things, tip of the tongue phenomenon, those kinds of problems.
Well, I'm working on some of that stuff myself as a as a consumer.
I think as we age, it really affects everyone. So there's tremendous interest in it.
Sure. As a matter of fact, I've ordered that Posit Science software. It hasn't arrived yet, and I've been using a program called Lumosity at lumosity.com.
That's another popular one out there. Yeah.
Yeah. So. But there's definitely that question in my mind, you know, is this just, am I just getting good at their games or is this going to generalize?
We don't know. We don't know. And as you recall from iBrain, we did a study where we looked at older people searching online and found that when they practice Google searching or Bing searching, that it activated the neural circuits. So, you know, these kinds of approaches are having an effect on the brain. We just don't know whether it really does much in terms of brain health and prevention of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
There's circumstantial evidence that it does.
You work with your wife on writing these books. The two of you collaborate, and since it's all about your life and it's written in the first person, I'm wondering how you two set up that collaboration.
Well, it's taken a number of years, and we've now written 5 books together, and we're going on our 6th one right now. And it's been a lot of fun. In the beginning, I was a little reluctant. I always thought, don't mix, you know, family life or business life.
Yeah.
It's something now that we really enjoy doing together, and she's become a better scientist, and occasionally she admits that I've become a better writer.
Okay. Well, I'm always impressed when husbands and wives can collaborate on something so challenging as writing a book. And one of the things that caught my attention in this case is that the stories actually include adventures with earlier girlfriends before you met your wife.
Yeah, well, she allowed me to keep a few of those things in.
Yeah, I would think that might be a delicate topic.
That's okay. You know, she had a previous life, too, before she met me. And
yeah.
I accept that.
Well, we probably should wrap it up here. Do you have any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with? And by the way, we'll definitely put a link to your book and to your website.
Great. Well, you know, I think that it's, you know, if people are interested in medical mystery, if they're interested in psychology and psychiatry and therapy, and I think there's a lot of people who are, this book would be something that you might want to pick up and take a look at. And I think you'll enjoy it and hopefully learn about it. And hopefully it'll help some people who are afraid of getting help to actually pick up the phone and reach out.
Yeah, definitely will, I think. Dr. Gary Small, thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, I certainly hope you enjoyed the second interview with UCLA psychiatry professor, researcher, and author Dr. Gary Small. By the way, if my voice sounds different, it's because I'm getting over a cold. At least I hope I'm getting over it. As you know, most of my interviews lately have been with authors, and that means between my two podcasts, I've got to get through about one book a week. I've been experiencing some minor visual challenges due to aging, and I've never been a really fast reader. So the truth is, I usually have to skim these books and do the best I can to extract enough information to formulate some good and relevant questions. Sometimes a book, though, will just pull me in, and I end up reading the whole thing, or most of it. Well, this latest book by Dr. Small and his wife, Gigi, is one of those that I ended up wanting to read the whole book. For one thing, it makes for easy reading. Each case is presented in its own short chapter, and with the dialogue and interior monologue, it's like reading a bunch of short stories. And of course, these case histories were chosen precisely because of their high interest value. I agree with what Dr. Small said about the value of this sort of book providing a window on the therapeutic process. It gives people who might be thinking about getting therapy for themselves some idea of what the process might be like, and it serves a similar purpose for those who think they might want to become therapists themselves. Each of the accounts gives some insights into the doctor's internal process as he considers various diagnostic and treatment options. There is a strong tradition already for this sort of book. I recall some of the ones that had a big impact upon me and many others as I was coming up through the ranks. The 50-Minute Hour by Robert Lindner was such a collection back in its day, and I think it might have been a bestseller even. Later, Love's Executioner by Irving Yalom, a Stanford psychiatrist, served a similar function. And a much lesser known but very important book in my own psychotherapeutic evolution was The Search for Existential Identity by James F.T. Buergenthal. All of this is to say, I think The Naked Lady Who Stood on Her Head falls into this noble lineage of case history books and is one you'd probably enjoy reading.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Well, by the time I get this out, it will be Christmas Eve. So allow me to wish all you who celebrate it a Merry Christmas. And also a belated Happy Hanukkah to all my Jewish listeners. And any appropriate seasonal greeting to the rest of you. If you're at all interested in neuroscience, you'll definitely want to catch the latest interview on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Dr. Joseph Ledoux on the synaptic self and memory reconsolidation. Dr. Ledoux is one of the heavy hitters of research on the brain. He was one of the people in a roundtable on the brain series of the Charlie Rose television show. Be sure to check out the various discount offers we have in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. For example, you'll find discounts for Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. And one of the new things you'll see there is an ad posted by one of our listeners in exchange for a generous donation. I'm referring to the tiny badge in the right-hand sidebar that says sobriety.ca. Click on it, and it will take you to Heritage Home Drug Rehab and Alcohol Addiction Treatment Center, located in rural Quebec. If you or someone you know needs residential treatment, this would be worth checking out. It looks to me like they have a very solid program. If you do contact them, be sure to mention you learned about them on Shrink Wrap Radio. Also, don't forget about our top 10 widget in the right-hand sidebar of the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage. Remember, anyone can purchase one of these little ads for a one-time fee of $20 right on the site, and it will stay up there until 10 more such ads come along and bump it off, which in all likelihood would be quite a long time. So this is one of the best advertising bargains around. I appreciate all your efforts to recruit new listeners by word of mouth, by blogging about the show, and by linking to favorite episodes on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks to all of you for clicking on that big green donate button on our homepage. Your one-time and ongoing donations help to keep the fires burning here. So a big thank you to all you donors, and to the rest of you, please consider adding your name to the honor roll of Shrink Wrap Radio supporters. Not to hint or anything, but it's not too late to give Shrink Wrap Radio a Christmas gift.
Hi, this is UCLA psychiatry professor and author Dr. Dan Siegel, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Dan Siegel, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag once again. First, we hear from Maureen, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, happy holidays. You're very welcome." She's saying, I had written to thank her for a generous donation. And she says, "You're very welcome. It's the least I can do for the free access to such enriching material you consistently provide. After listening to nearly every episode of both Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel, I look forward to what you will cook up in the coming year of shows." I like that. She goes on, "You know, you are literally in my pocket with me almost every day. As an interior plant tech, a fancy title for plant lady, I maintain live foliage in many corporate office buildings here in the Bay Area. Since I often work alone, I listen to my iPod while watering, dusting, and pruning my green friends. Having your podcast absorbed during the day really makes the day fly. It actually feels like your guests are with me as I venture from plant to plant, building to building. It also makes me think more seriously about pursuing further education in the world of psychology. As much as I love my job working with plants, I've always been drawn to psychology. I, too, was the friend people confided in and sought advice from growing up. The psych course I took in high school felt like second nature. When I was 12, I bought a box of used books from Santa Clara Central Park Library. Amidst a box of mystery paperbacks and sappy romance novels, I found a copy of Gerald Jampolsky's Love is Letting Go of Fear. For some reason, the book called out to me, so I bought it, along with a book called Following Your Sixth Sense. I think I paid $2 for them, and I don't remember who wrote the Sixth Sense book, as I don't have it anymore. But I read, kept, and reread Jampolsky's book throughout the years. Back then, I didn't know anything about A Course in Miracles. It's still quite an elusive text for me. It reads too much like the Bible. But I understood the idea of positive thinking and how to create positive energy. I used to write teach only love, for that is what you are, on my notebooks and binders. Having understood this idea at such a young age gave me a very wide lens with which to view the world. But with such a wide heart comes the vulnerability of psychological and emotional damage, if not protected. The perceived negative experiences in life have taught me to grow a thicker skin, thankfully. Learning to harness my own sixth sense, I wish I'd kept that book, it was a good one, has made it a little easier to navigate through this crazy maze called life. So I knew I had stumbled onto the right path when I found your podcast a few years ago. I believe your very first episode was about intuition. You can imagine my elation to hear your interview with Dr. Jampolsky 34 episodes later. It was like connecting with a long-lost friend. Ever since, I've continued to listen and absorb as much as I can from your podcasts. So many thanks again, Dr. Day, for hanging in with me at work, filling my head with knowledge and understanding. I will continue to carry you with me wherever I go. Take good care and enjoy the holiday. Much love, Maureen. And then she writes, P.S. My first thought on the open fly exercise, and she's referring to the creativity exercise in the previous episode with Harvard psychologist Dr. Shelley Carson. She says, my first thought on the open fly exercise was to admit it right away as well. Then I thought about untucking the shirt to cover the open fly or using a paper clip through the zipper and buttonhole to hold it shut. The stapler was a great idea, though. And then she writes, P.P.S. Please do another interview with Sarah Hanna Radcliffe. My husband and I loved her book, Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Voice. I have since gifted two copies of the book to friends and plan to send a few copies to family for Christmas. Wish my parents had had a copy when I was a kid. Well, Maureen, thanks for your donation and for that juicy and newsy email. It came just in time to keep December from being a very low month in terms of donations. I love the fact that you listen while doing your plant work, because one of my best friends, Bert Kaplan, whom I interviewed on Shrinkwrap Radio, also has a plant tending business he runs with his wife, and they even call it the Plant Lady. Skipping to the end of your email, I can tell you, coincidentally, that I've been talking with Sarah Hanna Radcliffe quite recently about another appearance on the show. She's one of my favorite guests as well. Now, the next email is from Mark, who also writes about the creativity exercise that Dr. Shelley Carson led us through. And he writes, Dr. Dave, here's what I came up with in the exercise. Misdirect attention away from my fly with conspicuous upper body and facial activity. Use the broken fly as an example, working it into the talk. That's the kind of thing I think I'd likely do. Here's another one. Hang some sort of a sign in front of my fly, drawing attention to the conspicuous sign so it doesn't look out of place. Work that sign into the talk. Great idea. Borrow a pair of pants from someone on the crew. And finally, give the entire talk with my back to the audience and work this into the talk. He says, keep up the great work on the podcast. I love it. My favorite topics are dream work, creativity, neurogenesis, and enhancement of cognitive abilities. Thanks, Mark. Well, Mark, those are some of my favorite topics as well, and I love the creativity that you applied to that exercise. I've also had several correspondences from Peter B. Todd of Shrink Wrap Radio number 240 on unconscious mental factors in HIV infection about the effects of my announcements on attendance at that psychoanalytic conference that took place recently in Sydney, Australia. You'll recall that Peter was one of the presenters there, along with Jonathan Shedler. In his most recent email, Peter writes, Dear David, apropos of size effects, I had asked him what effect my promoting the conference had, if any. He says, apropos of effect sizes, I've been invited to present a paper to the C.G. Jung Society in Sydney at their April meeting. I've also discovered that the president of the society here listens to your podcasts, as does the secretary. Apparently, he learned about the mind and matter paper as well as a recent psychoanalytic symposium on Shrink Wrap Radio. Great. So that's at least one person that learned about it here. He said, he goes on to say, a small sample, however, I thought you might like to know that Jungians here are becoming fans. As you know, I sent your brochure to the Secretary of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Jungian Analysts for distribution. And he closes with warm regards, Peter B. Todd. So, Peter, I really appreciate all your devoted efforts to helping promote Shrink Wrap Radio, even as I helped to promote that conference. Next, we hear from Tom, who, it turns out, is a graduate of Sonoma State University, where I've taught for many years. And he writes, Dr. Dave, a friend just returned from Seattle, where she learned of your podcast, and that SSU is a hotbed of depth psychology. Had I known, my major would have been different. As it was just fine. I'm nearing 70, retired for 2 years from teaching art in high school. It took 3 times to get a degree, but finally, and none too late. I don't have enough to live on, but we get by. Among my saviors is my former college counselor, Elsa Boghossian, who worked at Oakland City College and took me under her wing. I became acquainted with the writings of C.G. Jung after a dream precipitated a divorce. I was amazed that a dream could do such a thing, but also felt that a functioning human being of uncertain intellect ought to be able to change his own psychology some way. The first book was 2 essays in analytical psychology. The imperative to discover was there in spades, and I buried myself paragraph by paragraph and began writing in my journal in an entirely new way. I also began a correspondence with my former counselor. We heard of 2 films offered in Berkeley on C.G. Jung, one of which was the color interview with Lawrence Vanderpost, where we became aware of the existence of the Red Book. I was astonished and made up my mind to obtain the book if it ever saw the light of day. That was in the early 80s, when I learned of the advanced sales. I put my $100 in immediately. It came to me in the mail in October, and I showed it to friends down the street who were impressed enough to buy the book. Within weeks, we decided to organize a Red Book readers group of 2. Later that day, browsing our local bookstore, I overheard someone ordering the book. I approached him, and we instantly expanded our group to 3. We're 12 now, and just recently celebrated getting through the first book twice with barbecue ribs. No, we didn't thumb through the book that night. Yeah, you wouldn't want to get barbecue rib sauce on that $100-plus book. He says, our format is to pass the book around, each reading a chapter. We do not interpret. We let the words wash over us, trusting the sense to build, rather like a melting glacier might fill a lake. Everyone is totally dedicated to using our Friday nights this way. And in fact, we were forced to take a break from the weekly meetings because my wife and I became involved in a play, Oliver, put on by our local theater company, the Ukiah Players Theater. We really felt the absence. I don't know of any other such groups, but if they are out there, I sure would like to make contact with them. I recently saved Nancy Ferlotti's interview, number 242, hoping to make a CD for my new friends and Red Book colleagues. I hope this is okay to do. Yes, it's definitely okay to do. He goes on, childhood is wretched, but the alternative is worse. I suppose we're here to work it out. Thanks for these rich podcasts. Well, thank you so much for that email, and I love the way that you are using the Red Book in that group. And I take part in a small Jungian discussion group myself, and I'm going to share your idea with that group because I think we might want to steal that idea. So thanks for sharing all that information, Tom. And even though you didn't major in psychology, you're a good guy anyway. He signed it, a new listener, Tom, class of 95, bachelor's in English and a bachelor's in studio art at SSU. Next, here's one from Cheryl, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I love listening to Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. Over the past 5 years, I've completed 6 marathons. During my training runs, I always love listening to your interviews, giving both my body and mind a great workout. I'm currently a PhD student in social psychology. I'm on the fence about whether to continue a career in academia or to try something in the business realm. I'd love to hear a show discussing what people can do with a PhD outside of academia. And that's from Cheryl. And of course, Cheryl, there are many things that you can do outside of academia with a PhD in psychology. There are a lot of people in the high tech sector that I've run into as a result of my market research work, people who are product managers, people who are involved in marketing. Also, market research, of course, has been a great second career for me. And so that's another one that you might consider. And in my reply to Cheryl, I also encouraged her to become an entrepreneur. And finally, Paul sends in his vote for a shrink wrap radio iPhone app, which I had sent out an inquiry about to you all. And Paul writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I would love to have an iPhone app for your show. It would be great to listen to your show on the go. Just putting in my vote. Thanks, Paul." And I got back to Paul and said, of course, you can already listen to it on the go just by subscribing in iTunes or some other podcatcher and then loading it onto your whatever MP3 player you have. Or you can load it onto your MP3 or MP3 player directly from the website. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Gary Small for sharing some of his most bizarre psychiatric cases with us. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with UCLA psychiatrist and researcher Dan Siegel, MD, author of the very influential book, Mindsight. Now, this interview is another one in my series on mindfulness and the brain. If you are brainy and mindful, you definitely won't want to miss it. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.